You are listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie. My co-host Amy gets very excited to do things and does them big, capital B-I-G, but is then immediately exhausted, overwhelmed, and ready to go to bed. However, I have to give her credit because she at least does something while I sit at home.
Maybe you're just more self-aware. Maybe that's it.
Maybe I know my limits better. I don't know.
I'm Amy. My co-host Carrie likes dogs, but finds them too happy and needy when what she really wants is a grumpy cat, much like herself, who requires minimum work.
Yeah, I do kind of require minimum work. Basically, we're opposites, but we find common ground on our shared love of books. Each week, we chat about what we're reading with each other and sometimes a special guest.
We also dabble in other topics like books in the news, recent book-inspired films, our TBR counts, and general things that tease our brains. We're glad you're listening. This week's episode is one that big history nerds may find fascinating. In fact, big nerd Carrie could have gone even further down a rabbit hole with the ancient historian Herodotus than she did with our guest, Judith Lindberg. If you feel like playing a drinking game, like with your tea, your coffee, even maybe your liquor, with this episode, then between the three of us, we say the word fascinating at least 9 times. And just between you and me, I deleted a few more that were in there just because it was too much. But Judith's second novel, titled Akmarov, will be published on May 7th, and it is a sweeping story of a nomadic woman warrior in Central Asia during the 5th century.
Judith tells us about her inspiration for the novel, and you can find more about the Ice Maiden she mentions in our interview on her website, and how the matriarchal community in which Akmarol lives has connections to the mythological Amazons. Judith relates the challenges of women during the Iron Age to those that modern women have through her story. Akmarol is a perfect saga to check out if you're a fan of Madeline Miller.
But first, we want to remind listeners that April 13th is the last day to donate to Forward Radio, which is a community-run radio station that broadcasts our show locally in Louisville, Kentucky. We appreciate you supporting us and ask that you support them as they celebrate 7 years of bringing unique shows to listeners in our fair city and all over through their archives. Please visit forwardradio.org to make your donation.
I've got some news that we almost failed to mention, but we really need to mention it. Today, we're recording on Sunday. I don't even know what day it is. Sunday, April 7th. Today is International Beaver Day.
That's right. Our friend Bethany sent that to us, and I thought, oh, she must have listened to last week's episode and heard you talk about Beaverland and how fascinating you find beavers.
And Bethany is always in the know. She always knows what's going on. And I was like, please tell me you already knew this and didn't have to look it up. And she said her mom's favorite animal is the beaver. And so International Beaver Day is actually on their family calendar, which makes me like Bethany and her family even more. I didn't think that was possible. I was telling her about Akmarol, the book, because I was just, again, so fascinated by it. if anybody's listening to this, they may already be drunk. But she has been to Central Asia, where this book is set. At the beginning of the book, there's a map, and the setting is Kazakhstan. And Bethany has been there. And I was like, oh my gosh. So now I'm like, Kazakhstan and she has International Beaver Day on her family calendar. I mean, that friendship was meant to be.
She knows the way to your heart, which is like weird facts.
She totally does.
Well, I wanted to mention that a few weeks ago, a listener asked for a recommendation for a book set in Amsterdam. And I suggested Tulip Fever, but we had a listener write in on our Facebook and suggest a different one. The Last Painting of Sarah DeVos by Dominic Smith. It features a painting in several time periods, the 1600s in the Netherlands when it was painted, and then in the 1950s when it was forged, and 2000 when the two paintings meet in an exhibition. Great story. And so totally concur with this. I read that book as well and really enjoyed it. If you're interested in art forgery, it's particularly interesting sort of how they do it. And I did consider this book for that recommendation. The reason I did not was that the person who was looking for the recommendation said I would get bonus points if I had tulips in it. And so I suggested Tulip Fever because you can't get any more, you know, tulip heavy than a book called Tulip Fever, really. So also, it is a good segue for me to say, hey, who would like a book recommendation? I am willing and ready to give them. All you have to do is send us a message. I'm just sitting here all day just waiting for people to want me to give them a book recommendation.
There you go. Well, but tomorrow, right? They shouldn't email tomorrow because you are going to be busy on a little adventure, a little escapade.
Yeah, not tomorrow. Tomorrow is the day when there's going to be the full eclipse. And Louisville, Kentucky is just right outside the band where you're supposed to have the best viewing. And so my husband and I, our daughter and a friend, we're going to go to somewhere in Indiana. It remains to be seen exactly where we're going to go in Indiana to see the eclipse. My husband ordered eclipse glasses months ago. He could have just ordered a few, but he ordered a whole pack. So we have like 20 pairs of eclipse glasses.
Wow.
Now, I'm sure that he didn't realize that you would be able to get eclipse glasses everywhere. They're handing them out everywhere for free, but that's okay. You know, he was trying to be efficient and maybe he thought that they were going to run out of eclipse glasses. Maybe.
You know, we've all lived through the COVID toilet paper fiasco. So that's still fresh in all of our unconscious minds. We're still living under scarcity in some respects.
So I have to admit, I have never really thought about going to see an eclipse. I mean, there was a partial eclipse here a couple years ago that we witnessed, and you know, it was kind of cool. But I have heard people say that a full eclipse is like life-changing, which I'm having a hard time believing. But
or maybe they, you know, did some mushrooms right before the eclipse or something.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm interested to see. And since I don't have anything major going on Monday, I thought, well, why not? I'm going to try it out. Now, the plan is to go to a little town in Indiana called Seymour. But then I read today that the little town of Seymour is expecting over 100,000 people come to their town to see the eclipse. So I said to my husband, do we really want to go to Seymour? He wants to leave like early in the morning so that we can get a spot. Now, the eclipse is not going to happen till like 3 o'clock here. Mm-hmm. And so he's taking games and sandwiches and it's like a tailgating kind of situation. So actually, I need to talk to my daughter because I'm thinking she and I might want to do our own thing. Like she and I might want to see the eclipse, but maybe we just want to go and then pull off on an exit off the side of the road, see the eclipse, and then drive back home. I'm not really sure that I want to spend all day in a church parking lot in Seymour, Indiana,
well,
waiting for the
eclipse.
Well,
and you know, I mean, you haven't seen the movie White Noise, have you? Because this just popped into my head. Well, okay. So totally different scenario. In that one, there's a train derailment and this big cloud of fumes or whatever. But people are trying to escape the cloud and they end up like sitting in traffic. They're all like just on the highway. And right. So that's the thing about going to an eclipse or something like that. I'm like, ooh, what if you're just stuck in your car in traffic on the road? And
I know.
It scares me about doing that. That and that is way too many people. Way too people-y.
I know. I'm torn. Since we're just right outside the band, is it going to be that much different here than it would be there? I have heard yes.
I think you should go do it. If nothing else, it will be something for me to laugh at if it goes horribly wrong.
are you saying you don't want some of my 20 pairs of eclipse glasses? Like, I'm just going to drop some off.
I'm good. Because, see, what I'm going to be doing tomorrow is being big sad over spring break coming to an end.
Oh,
because tomorrow is our last day of spring break, and I am not ready for reentry. Everybody needed spring break, but we have 5 more weeks of slog. And so, I mean, the good thing is by the time we ramp back up, it'll be almost over. But man, you know, in the last month is testing and more testing and so I'm going to be busy like the next 5 weeks. So I'm just going to be at home thinking about you and how much fun you're having. Been Seymour, Indiana.
Oh, well, there is something else that I have been doing. I think we've mentioned it a little bit on the podcast, and I've been posting some pictures and I have gotten great response on them. So I'm going to talk about it a little bit more, which is that I take dogs on field trips from our local shelter. My daughter got me involved with this. She's a pre-vet student. She's doing an internship at our local animal shelter, Louisville Metro Animal Services. I've been doing it maybe since November. I started out doing it with her as like a fun thing to do with her. And now I do it on my own because a lot of she's too busy with the classes this semester to go with me very often. But basically, it's a program where you can go and pick out a dog that's at the shelter and take them out for a few hours. You can take them anywhere you want, but they have to stay on leash, you know, unless they're in a like a fenced area or something. Usually I take them to a store like Lowe's, which by the way, Lowe's is very dog friendly. You can take dogs into Lowe's and I'll usually take them for a walk. This last time I went to Little Free Libraries and delivered some books. I'll usually get them a treat. Like we'll go and get chicken nuggets or a pup cup or a cheeseburger. The point of the field trip, not only to get them exposure out into the public, but also it's really good for the dogs to get some time away from their kennel because those dogs are in their kennel for like, I don't know, 23 hours out of 24 hours a day. And you can imagine like days on end like that. I mean, they do get to go out and run around a little bit, but not a lot in comparison. It gives them a break and also allows volunteers like me to see their personalities. Because the way a dog is inside a shelter in a kennel can be very different from what they're like outside of that. Because being in a shelter is very stressful. It doesn't bring out the best in a dog, you know? And so I've had fun. I've been going once a week to do it. This week I was really excited. I took a dog who I call the dude because he reminded me of the dude from The Big Lebowski because he was super mellow, like super mellow.
Could probably handle a dog like him, like super mellow dog.
I just got word yesterday that he is going to a foster to adopt situation. So, you know, you can go and say, I think I want to adopt this dog, but could I foster him first to make sure it's going to work out? Mm-hmm. And so that's what happened with the dude.
The dude hopefully abides.
There's some studies that show that dogs who go on field trips or are fostered have like 1,000% more chance of being adopted
wow.
than other dogs. So, you know, it seems like something small, but I think it's like all those little small things end up to something big. So If this is something that, you know, anybody out there listening is interested in, if you're in the Louisville area, you just need to go online to Louisville Metro Animal Services and say you want to volunteer. There's like a small little introduction training you have to go to. It doesn't last very long. But I think other shelters around the country do this as well. You just might have to inquire about it. So
maybe this summer I'll go on one of these field trips with you.
But sure, you can come with me sometime. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
I might do that once.
Yeah.
Probably all I need one time. I'll be like, yep, this is good. I'm going to go back to my cats. Although I have to say, I mean, I do like going. Louisville has a couple cat cafes.
Yeah.
And I do like going to those.
I think that's a similar idea because if you can go in and you can pet the cat and you can kind of see what their personality is like, you're more likely to adopt them. And I think in the first year, they adopted out like almost 1,000 cats.
Yeah.
I mean, some kind of crazy big number.
Right.
They're great programs. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion.
And you know what? Personally, you know, as far as opinions go, Akmaral is in the 4 and 5 range for me. I did find it fascinating.
We've got to stop saying the F word. We've got to stop saying the F word. I think that it is
new. That should be our new like line for the show. We say the F word a lot.
A lot. That's right. Love it. Love it. Well, I think that we should now go and hear our F word guest, Judith Lindberg, about her book, Akmaral.
So not everybody has an interest in the Silk Road area of the world. Probably a lot of people don't even know where that is. But if you're a nerd like me, if you hear the Silk Road, you're going to be like, okay, what's going on? I got to read about this. And so when I discovered this book, it was floated by me and I saw Silk Road and I was like, I got to read more. So the book is called Akhmaral by Judith Lindberg. We're delighted to have Judith with us to tell us all about the book. So I'm going to completely nerd out this episode.
It's a pleasure to be here. And I'm equally a nerd, or I wouldn't have written a crazy thing like Akhmaral, a time nobody knows about, a place nobody knows about. It's my jam.
Well, let's start out. Would you give our listeners a brief summary of the book?
So Akhmaral is about a nomad woman warrior on the ancient Central Asian steppes in the 5th century BCE. So we're talking 2,500 years ago. And in fact, it is true that there were women warriors in this time period. Her journey is one of empowerment and discovery of what it means to be a woman and a warrior, and the struggle to balance love and motherhood with the requirements of her clan, and ultimately to become a leader. And I was inspired to write this, not because of Herodotus, which I'll talk about in a minute, but in fact, because of archaeology.
Well, and your website has some links to archaeological discoveries. And so I did go down those rabbit holes. I found it fascinating. So Silk Road, clans, warrior women, 5th century BC, correct? BCE. I'm all about that.
So I want to know what inspired this novel, because when most people are thinking about historical fiction, the big thing that flashes in front of them is World War II. And there are so many World War II historical fiction novels. They're not necessarily thinking of places that you write about. Like your first book was about Vikings in Greenland long, long time ago. And now this one, Women Warriors of Central Asia, what's now Kazakhstan. So honestly, it's kind of refreshing not to be World War II. So how do you pick your topics?
I love that you say that, because I love places nobody's ever heard of. And I love cultures that people don't really know, or think they know, but don't really know the essence and the truth of it. So for me, I go down these crazy rabbit holes because I'm curious and I want to learn about how people survived in places that are so distant and so difficult. With Akhmaral, it really did start with a documentary I saw on PBS about this fascinating burial that was discovered. So geographically, Kazakhstan and Mongolia meet in a little bit of a point, and Siberia is north and China is south. And there's this little spot where they all come together. And this burial was discovered in this valley called Pazarik, high in the mountains, surrounded by, you know, snow-capped peaks and this big green valley in between. And her body was preserved in the permafrost. And this woman is called the Siberian Ice Maiden. And because her body was in the permafrost, she had skin, and what her arms were covered with tattoos, and all her grave goods were preserved. There was a feast and meat on a table with a knife, and there was 6 horses that were sacrificed in her honor, and all kinds of other amazing things, and particularly a bronze mirror. And what I learned through my research was that bronze mirrors represent a spiritual component to this person's life. So we don't know for sure. There's definitely a sense that this woman was a priestess and a leader by the way she was buried. Then there was this other burial, which in my research, so I started with the Siberian Ice Maiden, and I'm like, okay, she's really cool. I want to know what all of this is about. And as I started digging in, I found another burial in Kazakhstan called the Golden Man of Izik. And Izik is a place. I could point it out on a map. And the thing about the Golden Man, he was buried again with these golden amulets and a huge headdress. There's both burials have these ridiculously tall headdresses, which is a fascinating aspect of it. But they didn't have enough DNA to know if it was a man or a woman. And back when they found him, they said, well, he's buried with weapons, so he's got to be a guy. And there are other things that since archaeologists have started opening up their thought process about how to interpret the archaeology. And now it's fairly well known that this probably was a woman. And I said, priestess, warrior, woman. And I dug into the history of the area. There's hundreds of burials, probably even thousands of burials of women who clearly died in battle and had weapons with them and all this stuff. But if you go to ancient writings from the Greek historian Herodotus, known as the first historian, you find out about the Amazon women. And there's a direct genetic connection between these burials and the Amazons, or what we think that were who the Amazons were. And that's how the story sort of started to form in my mind.
What is your background? I mean, were you like a history or an archaeology major in school or just an interest of yours?
Yeah. So my background is as an actor and a dancer. That was my first profession was dance. And then I was an actor for a while and it's long and complicated. But basically, I was bored at my temp jobs while I was trying to get acting jobs. And I started writing. Wow. I was like, okay, I'll look busy. I'll write a story. And then all of a sudden I started writing a novel. I didn't even expect to see it happen. But I've always been really fascinated with history and ancient history. I remember even in third grade, I think that was the year we learned about Egypt and Mesopotamia and Greece. And I just got every book I could and read everything I could about this, even as a little kid. And I always have been interested in mythology and different ways of interpreting, you know, belief systems. And I also love weird landscapes. So I love finding these remote places and just saying, how do you live in a place like this? And I know I don't have the strength and fortitude to survive most of the landscapes that my characters live in. So I'm sort of challenging myself from the safety of my office.
So let's talk about the region. You said it's kind of in this large area. The story takes place from Kazakhstan to Mongolia. You have a map at the beginning of the book to kind of help your readers determine where they are geographically. So what is it about the region that you find interesting, and why did it make such a great setting for the story?
Well, at the beginning of the story, the characters are living in what are today called the Altai Mountains, which are in that region that I described earlier. And they're very isolated. They're a tiny little group of people surviving by herding horses and camels and sheep. They travel where the grass is fresh and where the horses can graze. And they move from season to season to different places to graze their horses. And in the meantime, when they come down from the mountains, they get to the Central Asian steppes. And the word steppes with an E is essentially a great, like the Great Plains of the United States. Big, vast, open grasslands that go on for hundreds and hundreds of miles. And so, in fact, the story migrates from this high Central Asian area all the way into the region that is today the Ukraine. So we think about, you know, how these are different countries in our world. There are borders and boundaries and different cultures that have evolved in them. And the cultural shifts are historically accurate as well, although they're very different cultures than what are there today. But the idea that people could travel such vast distances on horseback and move organically with the seasons and be so deeply connected to the earth and the animals and the natural forces, to me, is a vital part of the story. And a lot of the spiritual and religious artifacts are animal-based. And so there's a lot of animal symbolism in the novel as well. And it really kind of speaks to something I feel like in our modern world, we forget that we are part of this planet and we are a product of this planet and we owe everything to it. So I wanted to explore that in the story.
Okay. So when I started reading your novel, and I started looking up the different groups of people who have lived in this area over history. I mean, It is so complex.
I know.
And I was really blown away by how many different groups of people have come in and out of that area over 2,000 years.
Yeah.
It's really mind-boggling. But yeah, the people, the Sauromaite, who were they and what was their culture like? And is that the culture that Akhmaral is part of?
Yeah. The Sauromaite is the name of her culture. So according to Herodotus, book four, nerddom here, after the Trojan War, the Amazon warriors were taken back to their land by ship. And along the way, they hijacked the ship because they don't like being taken by other people. And the problem is they didn't know how to sail. So they crashed at what is today the Crimea in the disputed area of Ukraine, and went off into the steppes. This is the flat grasslands of the steppes, and stole a bunch of wild horses and rode off. Now, this is the region where the Scythians, who debatably are related to all of this, the Scythians live in this area. And along the way, they run into a band of Scythian warriors. And of course, they have a battle. And it's not until they're about to kill them that they realize, oh no, these are not men, these are women. And as is almost always the case in Greek stories, the battle turns to courtship. And
always.
And eventually the Amazons accept the Scythians as lovers. And I phrase it on purpose that way because that's a key aspect of what I'm trying to get at in this novel. They accept the men. The men don't take the women. And eventually they say, well, we want to stay together. So the women say, I'm not going back with you to Scythia, where I don't get to be powerful and do what I do and be a warrior and a hunter and an independent woman. You guys come with me. And they go off further and further to the east until they settle in the high mountains. And this is the location of the Sauromaite. They become the Sauromaite.
Mm.
So Herodotus's book is called Histories, and it is regarded as history, but a lot of what he wrote, especially regarding these more distant tribes, is hearsay. Mm. So we don't know for sure, and it is the only written record about these people. And everything since then has been built off of what he wrote. So we don't know anything for sure. And there's no written records from the Scythians or the Sauromaite themselves. So I wanted to go beyond the Amazon warrior myth, which we all are very familiar with. And it's very popular, you know, Wonder Woman is an Amazon,
right,
and all of
right.
that. And that's great. And I love that. But I wanted to kind of take this a little bit more seriously and dig into what this world would have been like. And that's where I started drawing on the archaeology to build a culture that would have been a world where women were equal with men. And not just because one or two women decided, oh, I'm going to break the rules and be, you know, take my own path, but actually born equal with equal responsibilities, equal skill and training, equal opportunities for leadership. It is a matriarchal culture, meaning that the women were in charge. That doesn't mean that the men weren't in charge. I intentionally added some male leadership because I felt like in an equal society, there's equal. You don't cut one side out in favor of the other, but everybody does what they're best at. And that's what I really wanted to try to achieve in the novel.
So when readers meet the protagonist, Akhmaral, as a young girl, when she's taken almost in secret by her parents to meet this female shaman who tells her that her destiny in the opening scene, we see her develop as a warrior. So how did you go about creating her character?
She's very much loved from the very beginning. Her parents love her. Even after something terrible happens, the rest of the tribe embraces her. And I wanted her not to be the kind of warrior who's bloodthirsty and hungry for power. I wanted her simply to want to do well at the task at hand. She's not rightly confident or determined that she's going to be the best. She just does the best she can. And by doing the best she can, she becomes stronger. And she's always questioning. She's questioning her role in their society. She's questioning her best friend, who is a very good hunter, but doesn't really want to kill. And in their culture, and also in Herodotus, you cannot marry unless you have killed someone in battle. So it was a requirement. And to me, it made sense. I was trying to rationalize the history. Like, why would that be? If you are in a small group and survival is a daily concern, you can't add to the population if you haven't already contributed to the population. And that was the role that the warriors had to fulfill before they could move on to the next stage of life, which is to marry or have children or whatever formal arrangement we want to call it. So I wanted her always to be wondering what all of these requirements and responsibilities really added up to. And so she grew out of this questioning, open need to find her place in the world. And I added a lot of details, like there's a hunt at the beginning of the book, and she has to go out and she has a, you know, kind of traumatic experience. And from it, she learns. I've discovered how you hunt for boar, in at least a semblance. I mean, I'm sure modern day hunting, boar hunting is very different. There were no guns. So, you know, I've never gone on a hunt for boar. So I did my best.
Well, it was believable because I've never been on a hunt for boar, but I was like, okay, we're hunting boar. Here we go.
Yeah, I know. I'm not a violent person by nature. I'm very peaceful in yoga, and I had to go and kill people a lot in this book. And so, yeah. You know, I had to get myself ready to do these violent things because they were required. So because she does not relish battle, she doesn't want to do these things. It's always defensive. And if ever it isn't defensive, that's a cultural anomaly that has to be dealt with and disciplined. So I would play this very serious, dark, heavy music when I would write these battle scenes. And in fact, it's music from the region. So that part of Siberia is now called Tuva, T-U-V-A. And there is a traditional kind of musical technique called Tuvan throat singing.
I've heard of that. It is so fascinating to me. I know. Didn't mean to bust your eardrums, but
no, it's
God. Sorry.
I'm glad you've heard of it because it's really weird. And it has this overtone music and it's very interesting. And it was, again, when I dig into these strange areas, I'm trying to find modern ways to get into the past. And I mean, the culture of Tuva is very different than Scythia and from the Sauromatae, but there's a regional connection. So I found these fabulous recordings of Tuvan throat singing. And what's funny is a lot of them sound like horses. The rhythm of it is like horses, but some of them are very drone-like. And I'd find this music and I'd put myself in a state and I would feel like, okay, I have to go to battle and I'm not happy about it. And I have to get myself ready and I have to be strong and I have to face what's ahead of me. And so as I do that, she gets stronger. So this is where my acting comes in. I spend a lot of time, you know, I spend a lot of time being my characters, you know? And so I want to experience the dread and the seriousness and the not frivolity of violence. And ultimately her recognition of the tragedy of what daily life is leads her to make choices that she hopes will make things better for her people.
That's actually a fascinating connection that you just made. And I'd never thought about it, how somebody who is an actor or maybe has a history with that would use that same technique to write, enveloping that character.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, I do occasionally get up and act out my scenes in my office here. And another thing, because I had to learn some skills for her. And I learned how to do a little bit of archery. I'm not very good, but I would go in my backyard. At the time, my kids were young, and I had the old baby mattress and a little play school colorful slide. So I stuck the slide against the steps of the mattress, and I would go in the backyard. It was like a little kid's bow and arrow. It wasn't anything serious, trust me. And I would practice, and I would shoot the baby mattress. It's kind of horrifying. And then one time, time I overshot and I shot a hole in the neighbor's fence. They have a PVC fence. So I'm like, okay, let's stop because my neighbor's patient, but not that patient. Let's go. But I really wanted to experience what it was like. And I went on a lot. I don't ride horses a lot, but I went as many times as I could to feel what it was like to horseback ride. And there's a lot of interesting crafts and skills, like how to make felt. So if you take the lint from your dryer and you can kind of make a sort of felt, it's not good unless it's really wool, but it works. So I taught myself some of these skills. So maybe that's the actor in me too. But I felt like, how can I write about this stuff if I don't at least try to give myself a semblance of the experience?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Well, you talk about the fact that Akmaral's clan, her society, women are part of it. You know, mm-hmm. it's matriarchal. And so one of the things that I found especially fascinating was the sexual freedom mm-hmm. that the warrior girls had. So, I mean, it makes logical sense, but when, you know, when you've been raised in the United States with kind of our puritanical girls, we don't talk about sex. It was really kind of like, oh, wow. So I'm just curious about that aspect of your book. And is there evidence of that in the historical record, you know, that you've talked about?
You know, it's interesting. There was, along with my research and also thinking through the logic of it and trying to figure out how this would work, there were a few documentaries and books I did read that talked about sexual freedom and the necessity, because they're such a small clan, to find partners from other tribes, and whether it was voluntary or not, we can discuss that another point. But if we go back to Herodotus and women had to kill in battle before they could choose a mate, implies that they are in control of their personhood and that they are not considered property, which is such a European Western, you know, relationship with sex and marriage. And I wanted Akmaral to choose who she was with and why she was with them. And at one point, she's in a relationship with someone who's coming from the outside, who brings that patriarchal mentality into the tribe. And she's so stunned by it because it's so completely foreign. And yet she loves this man.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to wrestle a little bit with that very same question of what we are in the United States are raised with in Western culture's assumptions about male and female relationships. I wanted her to come up against that foreignness of not being acknowledged as a whole and independent person with choice. And in fact, she's, you know, in certain sense, she's the aggressor and she's the one who puts the limits. And we talk about no means no. Mm-hmm. No means no in this world. There was no question. She told somebody no in this book. And there was, even though, you know, maybe we could talk about size and strength, but that was not happening here. She was just as dangerous and threatening as anyone else. And when she said she what she wanted, that's what she got.
One of her struggles in the book, especially as she gets older and the novel progresses, mm-hmm. is melding sort of that warrior and leadership role mm-hmm. with her role as a mother. Mm-hmm. And so the novel starts, she's a young warrior, and then she has her motherhood stage, you know, mm-hmm. and then she kind of circles back into that leadership warrior stage. And yeah. It felt very cool, I think, to think about women of the past struggling with a lot of those same issues that women now struggle with. You know, like women who go to college and they prepare for a career and then they have children in their 30s and they kind of leave that part behind. And then you get a little bit older and your children grow up. And so talk to us a little bit about writing it so that it's in the time of the Iron Age, but it's also very relatable to modern women.
Yeah, I'm glad you saw that connection because, you know, often people are like, ancient history, what does that have to do with our modern life? But I think that that was one of my goals, to recognize the stages of womanhood and to question what we lose when we become a mother as well as what we gain. I mean, I am so glad I had my kids and they've taught me to be a better person on every single level. But also I struggled to retain my own work and my own identity throughout those years. With Akmarel, you know, the minute she has a child, her place in the tribe changes. It's not that her warrior qualities are eliminated. And trust me, if someone came and attacked, they would all jump in and protect each other. But her biggest responsibility is to take care of her child. As things progress and her sense of what nurturing really is, it expands, not just to the individual of her child and her relationship and her little insular family, but the protection of the entire clan. And it even grows beyond the clan to the larger context of who's attacking us and why, and what do they want, and how can we come together and stop this violence and conflict and instead protect a larger group of people. So I think her struggles with identity and motherhood and returning to her responsibilities as a warrior and a leader, she struggles at every stage. She questions her responsibility to herself and to those she loves and to her larger community. Mm-hmm. And I think the question of women's leadership is the question of any leadership. What are we trying to do? Are we trying to build ourselves up as individuals and gain power? Or are we there to make the world better and safer for each other? So she extends that motherhood experience into the rest of her life.
I wanted to ask you a little bit about your first novel, The Thrall's Tale. It's set in 10th century Greenland in an early Viking Age settlement. So what did you learn about writing historical fiction from your first book that you were able, you know, to carry over into writing Akmarel?
Oh my gosh. Well, I learned so much from The Thrall's Tale, and I love that book, and it's very dark and it's very depressing. And I am no longer that dark and depressing, so this is slightly less depressing. but I really love language, and maybe it comes from my acting background because I, you know, spent a lot of time doing Shakespeare and Chekhov and Shaw and things like that. So I love language, and I want my historical fiction to read not like Shakespeare. God help, nobody wants to work through that unless they have to. But I want the tone and the quality of the language to somehow echo the times that they were written in. And I work really hard with my language to give it a rhythm and a pacing and a subtle shift of syntax. Not so subtle in Thrall's Tale, if you ever read it, not so subtle, but a subtle shift of syntax that it doesn't feel contemporary. And it's hard because I think a lot of historical novels are written in a contemporary tone, but they're about a different time and place. And I'm like, well, that's good. I'm entertained, but I don't feel immersed. And I really believe in immersion when I write. That maybe that's why I spend so much time acting things out in my house. I want to be the characters, and I want my readers to be with me in that time and place and feel the cold and the struggle and the weight and the joy. There's also happiness and there's also hope, but a lot of that comes through language. And it takes me a long time. I'm a relatively slow writer, which is unfortunate, but because I'm always working the language and trying to find the rhythms and the tone and bring that drone of the tube and throat singing into the language itself. And whether readers know that that's where it's coming from or they just sense it, then, you know, I really want that experience to be part of what I do as a writer.
Carrie, I'm thinking we should find some recordings of the throat singing and make that our episode music.
I think we should. Although that might alienate like everybody who tunes in because, you know, it's a little jarring.
I agree with you. It might freak people out. My husband, when he was working in an office, now he works at home, he had my playlist running in his office one day. And, you know, all of a sudden, and his boss came in, what the hell is this? And he was like, oh, it's Judy's stuff. Don't just ignore it.
Have you been able to travel to either of these places, Greenland or
back in the day, this is pre-kid, I was able to take a ship from Iceland to Greenland following the path that the Vikings would have taken to the settlements.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was absolutely life-changing and so powerful. But when I was working on Akmaral, my kids were little. And my husband said, you know, I love you. And I know you're like, want to do what you want to do. But we have kids. And so I never made it there. But Google Earth is a magical tool. And I was able to use it for literally like going down and being on the top of mountains and looking around and going to rivers. And I did as much as I physically could do to be in those places. The other cool thing, I was doing a talk up in Canada. I didn't know this. We were driving from one city to another in Alberta. And I said, you know, the landscape here kind of looks like the book I'm working on. And my host was saying, well, this is called the Canadian Steppes. And I said, oh, so even though I wasn't in Mongolia or Kazakhstan, I was in a place that felt very similar for a short while. So yeah, I'd like to go. Someday I'd like to go because I feel like that one piece, I'm sure if I go, I'll have all kinds of interesting things to, oh, I wish I'd known that when I was writing the book. Yeah.
So I actually have, if you haven't read it, a book recommendation for you. Uh-huh. Have you ever read the book Rough Magic by Laura Pryor Palmer?
No.
Have you heard of it?
No, not at
all. It's a memoir by a woman who, when she was 19, and she's British, she went to participate in the Mongol Derby, which it's billed as the longest, toughest horse race in the world. And it, you know, takes place in Mongolia. And mm-hmm. it's 1,000 kilometers across the Mongolian grassland. And she was the youngest and first ever female winner.
Wow.
And it was a really fascinating story about her experience doing it. And I think she rode 25 ponies because their horses are a little bit different. They're smaller, but they're like sturdy and compact and, you know, riding these horses across the country and her experiences with the locals. And, you know, that's, it might be something you might want to as a modern day in that area. But when you were talking, it made me think about that area because I had read that book.
Yeah.
So
what you clearly do know what you're, because that's exactly the kind of horses they have are much smaller and they're much hardier. And they do the horse racing. Even there's a Mongolian festival called Nadam. And every year they do horse racing and archery and wrestling. And the wrestling is kind of different. Check it out. It's online. You can see it. But it's exactly that, except it's from their traditional festival that they're doing even to this day. So I took a lot of that modern stuff and then kind of deconstructed it into where its origins came. So that's exactly, it's a great recommendation. I'll totally check it out.
Yeah.
Honestly, I could keep you on here for hours and hours just talking about all of this stuff, because again, I just find it so fascinating. And as Amy said, so refreshing for historical fiction. And I thought the book was amazing. And I'm, like I said, I'm passing it along to a friend. So we want to thank you for being with us. We are going to take just a short break. Mm-hmm. And when we come back, we're all going to talk about what we're reading.
But before we talk about what we're reading, we're going to hear from a fellow book lover who's going to tell us about their most recent 5-star read.
I'm Linda Leffler, a bookstagrammer from Nova Scotia. My 5-star review is for The Fair Botanists by Sarah Sheridan, a novel set in 1822 Edinburgh about a friendship between a poor widow, Elizabeth, who tries to follow the rules, and an upmarket courtesan, Belle, who makes her own rules. Many of the scenes take place in the Botanic Garden, where a giant agave plant captures the attention of the world as it's about to bloom for the first time in 30 years. The blossom has taken its own time and causing anxiety for everyone who covets it. This book evokes a certain period, Georgian or Enlightenment Edinburgh, and Sarah Sheridan's sparkling prose makes a refreshing change from Regency novels set just a few years earlier. I have a meet-cute story for this book. Last year, I met an Edinburgh tour guide who in her other life is a Lucy Maud Montgomery scholar. Naturally, we had some recommendations to trade, and that's how I found Sarah Sheridan's Edinburgh novel, The Fair Botanists, 5 stars. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast.
We are back with Judith Lindberg, the author of Aquarol, and of course I have my co-host Carrie here. Carrie, what have you been reading?
So I read an audiobook fairly recently, and my son, I was driving him somewhere, my 14-year-old, he listens to his phone using his earbuds or whatever. And he said, well, if you want to listen to your book in the car, you can. They won't bother me. So I started listening to this in the car. And when we got to where we were going, he said, are you and Dad okay? And I said, I knew you were going to ask that. So let me tell you, this book is called This Is How Your Marriage Ends, a hopeful approach to saving relationships by Matthew Frey. So the poor kid, you know, he could hear it and he thought, oh no, mom and dad are, things are coming to a head. So I had to say, no, we're not breaking up. So I heard about this book after reading Frey's essay, which went viral. So it was called She Divorced Me Because I Left Dishes by the Sink. So it went viral and it was eventually published in The Atlantic, which is where I read it. And the gist of his message in the essay in the book is that it isn't the big issues that break a relationship. It's the small things that show our partners how little we care about what they feel and think. So leaving dishes by the sink when your partner has made it clear that this bothers them, and then trying to convince them why they are silly to be bothered by dishes in the sink is a recipe for relationship failure. And it sounds like this was Frey's MO for his entire marriage. Later in the book, he even discusses how he did things like this before he married his wife. And he says outright, she never should have married me. And so it took Frey's wife leaving him for him to figure out that perhaps his wife wasn't the overly sensitive shrew he imagined her to be, and that he had contributed to the failure of the relationship. So he's kind of writing to men like himself who don't understand why their partners get so upset over something that's not a big deal to them. And then they try to convince their partner, well, you're silly. Just don't get upset about that. And so reading the book, you can kind of see like, oh, I see why your marriage fell apart. And hopefully men who, you know, read this book will maybe everything will click and they'll start seeing, oh, maybe I do this too. So he's now kind of a relationship coach trying to help men understand and sort of learn from his mistakes. So again, it's called This Is How Your Marriage Ends, A Hopeful Approach to Saving Relationships by Matthew Frey. So
I can understand why your son was, a little concerned.
Yeah. And I'm like, no. But I mean, in some ways, it was kind of good because I was able to tell him, because we've been married for 26 years. And I said, you know, your dad and I, we've gone to marriage counseling. You know, we have had issues that we needed to talk to. And he said, well, what's marriage counseling? And then I explained, you know, they talk to me alone, they talk to your dad alone, they talk to both of us together, and it helped us in our relationship. So I think that's important for my kids to know that, you know, I mean, we have a good relationship, but we've had our rough periods too. And we asked for help. We found help and that helped us improve our relationship. So it was a good empowering moment, I think. Well, Judith, what's something that you've been reading and enjoyed?
I have 2 recommendations.
Awesome.
One is more in the realm of what I write, which I, you know, love to find books that are similarly rich and historical and complex. I'm reading The Mercies by Kieran Millwood Hargrave. It's a few years back and it's been sitting on my pile for a while and I finally got a chance to get into it, and it's absolutely stunning. Similarly rich language and complex tone, which not impenetrable, but beautifully written. And it's about a village in the 1600s in Norway that it's like a fishing village. All the men are out to sea when a storm comes in and sweeps them all away. So the community loses all its men. And the women have to figure out how to survive and what happens with this, the world without men. So it's sort of thematically interesting in relation to what I'm doing. It's beautifully written and very powerful. And then I also recently finished and cannot wait to go back to The Comfort of Crows by Margaret Renkel. If you haven't seen this book, go and buy the copy. Don't buy the ebook because it's stunning. The volume itself is so beautiful. It's a collection of essays by the wonderful Margaret Renkel, who writes pretty regularly in the New York Times about nature and the environment and our relationship with it. And the essays talk a lot about her filling her bird feeders and going for a walk and being with nature. But it's also a lot about aging and accepting the passage of time and acknowledging where you are in the parenting process and moving beyond the child rearing into whatever comes next. And each chapter is accompanied by beautiful collages done by her brother, Billy Renkel, who's an artist. And it's just such a beautiful work to hold. And I love it. And it really speaks to my other passion, which is, you know, the planet and the environment and paying attention to this beautiful place we live.
I didn't talk about that specific book, but I talked about her first book, Late Migrations, just a couple episodes ago, which I loved, and mentioned that I had bought myself for Christmas Comfort of Crows. I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited to. I'm a huge Margaret Renkel fan.
All right. Well, Amy, what about you? What have you finished up lately?
So recently I read a book called I Have Some Questions For You by Rebecca Mackay. And I've been wanting to read a Rebecca Mackay book for quite a while because I've heard such great things about her books. A lot of people might have heard of The Great Believers, which was very popular a few years ago. But my nudge was when she came recently to the Louisville Free Public Library to do an author event. And this is her most recent book, and it just came out in paperback. The setting of the book is a boarding school in New Hampshire, where our main character, Bodie Kane, went to school in the 1990s. And now she's a successful film professor and a podcaster. And the school has asked her to come back to teach a 2-week course during their winter session about podcasting. So one of her students wants to do a true crime podcast series about a murder that happened at the school during Bodie's time there. In fact, the girl murdered was Bodie's roommate for her junior year. And so Bodie has had suspicions for a long time that the man who was convicted of the murder, who was a Black athletic trainer at the school, isn't the true killer. So going back to her school 30 years later brings back so many memories, and she becomes completely consumed with the case, even while her personal life is also falling apart. So this book is a murder mystery, but it's definitely more in the literary fiction landscape. It examines the Me Too movement, cancel culture. Why are we so obsessed with the murders of women? You know, I'm thinking about true crime and young women being such a popular thing right now in TV and in the media, and also how our memories can morph and change based on the circumstances. So this was a real page turner for me. I read it in about 2 days, and it's a pretty hefty book, and that is really unusual for me. This book, I think, could please lots of different readers, those who like true crime, those who like mysteries, dark academia, and even those readers who themselves came of age in the 1990s. Mackay herself went to a boarding school like this. And in fact, she lives on the campus of one right now because her husband is a teacher at a boarding school outside of Chicago, and they live on the campus there. Although she says that the one in her book is not based on that school, just that she has herself, you know, attended a boarding school.
That could be a PR problem.
Anyway, I highly recommend, and Rebecca Mackay was a fabulous speaker. And so if you ever have the chance to go to one of her events, take it. Her answers were really engaging and thoughtful, even if you haven't read her book. And there was this adorable moment when this 10-year-old girl comes up to the microphone and asks a question. She wants advice. She says she wants to be a writer. And what advice would you give a kid who wants to be a writer when they grow up? And Mackay was so good with her, basically said, don't let anyone tell you not to. Anyway, the name of that book again is I Have Some Questions For You by Rebecca Mackay.
Sounds good. Well, we have been chatting with an author who's given really great answers yes. to the questions that we've asked. While you were saying that, I was like, hey, we have one of those here right now with us. We want to thank Judith Lindberg, author of Akmaral. It comes out in early May. Is that right?
May 7th. Yes.
Go out and look for it. Akmaral by Judith Lindberg. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to chat, and I really appreciate everybody listening.
You can find Judith Lindberg at her website, judithlindberg.com, and on Instagram at Judith Lindberg.
For show notes for any episode, visit our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabookloverpod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover. To send us a message, go to our website and click the contact button.
If you enjoy listening to us each week, tell a friend or write us a review on your favorite podcast platform to help other book lovers find us.
And finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there, live or in archives at forwardradio.org.